Welcome to Stateside, everyone. I'm Cynthia Canty. Happy Monday. You know, there are many ideas and many strategies being talked about for how we keep young people in Michigan. On our show today, we speak with one young writer who says all of that talk is simply not enough. And then we hear how refugees, having survived physical and psychological traumas in their home countries, are getting mental health services here in Michigan. But first, focus is beginning to turn to election 2014 in Michigan. Former Democratic Congressman Mark Schauer filed paperwork this morning to run against Governor Rick Snyder in 2014. That's assuming that the governor does, in fact, decide to run for a second term. And Democratic Congressman Gary Peters, of course, announced earlier this month he's running for the U.S. Senate seat that opens in 2014 because of Carl Levin's retirement. So it appears the Democrats are starting to get their ducks in a row. What about the GOP? Joining us now is Bobby Shostak. He's chairman of the Michigan Republican Party. Welcome to Stateside.
Good afternoon. It's good to be with you.
So is that a fair statement, Bobby, that it appears that Democrats, at least in these two races, are ready and they're in it, but we don't see a Republican yet?
Well, in terms of the Senate seat, you've got to remember that Senator Levin announced his retirement very early in the cycle, in the process. While we had been seeing signs of it as a possibility, it's not, you know, and we're not in any kind of position where we're considering ourselves either late or anything at this point. There's a lot of time. It's May of 2013. It's not, you know, 2014. Normally, we have a process at our Mackinac conference in September where likely candidates for the statewide offices begin to appear, and we expect that to be the case. Now, saying that, we've got several people looking hard at it and several people saying they're going to run. They just haven't formally announced, like both Peters and now Mark Schauer have for the governor's seat. So we're feeling really good about it. It's a year when Governor Snyder is continuing to improve in the polls and has strong numbers. Michigan is improving every day in terms of our economy and all measurement points of a state that's in a recovery mode after losing a decade, as we did from the past administrations. And so we're feeling pretty good about this election cycle and where we'll end up being with our top of the ticket.
Well, let me ask you this. How does a later GOP entry affect the races in terms of your messaging and in campaigning and in fundraising?
Well, I would say this, that, you know, look, the filing date is May of next year. Backing up from there, you know, 6 months or so, you know, that's kind of like what would want to target, that you know, you'd have your candidates, you know what your primary is going to look like. We're not late. We're not early. We're, I think, right where we'd like to be. But in terms of how it may affect things is that we think primaries are a good thing. It makes for better candidates. The fact that Gary Peters is not going to have a competitor, that's not going to allow him to sharpen up his tools. And he's never run statewide before. He's not been necessarily a successful congressman for very long. He's got a number of things from his history of being in the United States House that will work against him, Obamacare being one of them, and being a part of all of the related expenditures of the Obama administration that he's voted for. So he's got a lot to defend. We have a lot to point out to the Michigan voters, which we'll be doing. And our candidates will, I think, find themselves tuned up, prepared, adequate resources to financially take on the challenge. And we'll be in really good shape.
I think I hear you saying you expect a primary for that Senate seat. Who might you expect us to see running for that seat from the GOP?
Well, right now, you know, the names that we're all hearing and are having serious conversations, both internally with perhaps their families as well as their advisors, and then externally with voters and the state party, you know, are Congressman Mike Rogers, Congressman Justin Amash, former Secretary of State Terry Lynn Land, former candidate for the United States House Rob Steele, and others that have you know, begin to talk through what it makes sense for them to run. Can they reach the Michigan voter and connect with them? Will they have adequate resources to run a statewide campaign? And so, I mean, we've got a number of very strong names recognizable names, successful officials that have been involved in the conservative agenda of our state and our country. And we're feeling pretty good that it's not late, it's not early. We're right where we'd like to be, is to have a field established, which I'm pretty certain will include at least two candidates by early fall.
I want to talk a little history about that Senate seat, if we might. When you look actually at both Michigan Senate seats, you've had Carl Levin's lock on it since he beat Republican Robert Griffin in 1978, and then Senator Stabenow's seat, you had Spencer Abraham with that single term from 1995 to 2001, and that was the only win for the GOP since Charles Potter, I think, back in the 1950s. So what kind of chance do you honestly think that a GOP candidate would have of replacing Carl Levin? What do you think it would take?
Well, I think that right now, if you look at the turnaround of Michigan, there's a very good story of Governor Snyder, our Republican-led House and Senate, and the fact that we are now a right-to-work state, and that some of the policies of Governor Snyder and legislature are now taking hold, and we're seeing a profound Michigan recovery taking place. And I think those talking points, those tangible outcomes, are things that Michigan voters, Michigan citizens can relate to. And as they, the candidate for Senate aligns themselves with those successes and that story, that will give them a pretty good jump on running statewide for United States Senate. That, along with obviously having adequate resources, which has not been the problem of the Michigan Republican Party on statewide elections. You know, we're always able to, through our donor base and our various candidates, been able to raise, you know, more than adequate dollars to be successful. Building a great ground game, which we're doing at the state party. Our new political plan is being touted by other Republican parties, state parties around the country, as well as BNC as being really at the top of the class in terms of being a very well thought out, properly funded, very strong campaign. And I think that any of our candidates that latch onto that ground game, we're going to see a lot of benefits come their way, because it's a very grassroots-driven activity that will have a very serious amount of dollars put towards the political technology and the game plan associated with building a ground game.
Do you feel that any one of these potential GOP candidates could win over Michigan voters who maybe don't feel that Governor Snyder is reflecting their views, or they don't feel that right to work was a victory? Can they talk to those voters, to those who don't feel as pleased with the way things are going as others might?
Well, I think one thing that Governor Snyder has been very good at, among other things, has been to connect with the independent voters of Michigan. You know, pretty much close to a third of all voters consider themselves independents versus, you know, a specific party, which means they tend to align with a candidate more than a party specific. And Governor Snyder's, I think, been able to reach out to those folks in dealing with them on non-political terms, dealing with them as just citizens of Michigan. They're looking for a better Michigan, looking for a stronger place to raise their family, a place where they can have security in their job and see economic growth, and as well as have a state that they can be proud of for all of the great attributes that the state offers. And the governor has been very, I think, very successful in reaching all voters in that regard and explaining to them, you know, why certain things, certain policies are necessary that may be controversial or maybe personally stressful to a individual voter, yet nevertheless brings you know, prosperity and a better future, you know, to families in Michigan. And I think our Senate candidate would be able to latch onto that and succeed because of that.
Let me just circle back to where we started with the news that former Democratic Congressman Mark Schauer filed that paperwork to run against Governor Snyder. What does that mean for you as the GOP? Do you feel it puts you on offense or defense?
Look, we expected that they'd have a candidate very short order. They did. We have been tracking the likely folks that would be running for some time. We know their strengths and weaknesses. We see a lot of opportunity with Mark Schauer to point out to Michigan voters his deficiencies, his lack of leadership, the decisions he's made in Washington that have been adverse to Michigan. And we will make that very clear that when you're voting for higher taxes and more spending and more regulation, it's wrong for Michigan. And we will get that message out loud and clear. And so we see him as very vulnerable and someone that we will certainly show the contrast between a great leader who has made tough decisions, who has made it possible for Michigan to move from the bottom, 10% in the nation to the top 10% in the nation in only 2 years. And I think that itself will speak volumes to the Michigan voters.
I've been speaking with the chairman of Michigan's Republican Party, Bobby Shostak. Thank you so much for talking with us today, and I'm sure we'll be talking again soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I look forward to it.
Last year, some 8,100 refugees and asylum seekers fled their home countries, and they came to Michigan hoping to start a new life. Now, many of these people may have wanted to stay at home, but war and organized violence made it impossible, and the United States opened its doors to them. The World Health Organization estimates a full 50% of these refugees are suffering from mental illness. But the doctors and the therapists who work with these refugees, many believe that number is too low. What is life like for these wartime refugees and asylum seekers in Michigan? And what's being done to ease their transition into their new life and help treat these people as they suffer from psychiatric disabilities? Hussam Abdulkhalik is the program supervisor at the Access Psychosocial Rehabilitation Center. Access is based in Dearborn. It is the largest Arab American human services nonprofit in the nation. It has many, many years of good work in the community to point to. And we're very pleased that Hussam could join us here in the studio. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. I'm honored.
Well, tell us, give us an idea, where are your clients from? What countries have these refugees and asylum seekers tended to come from?
The majority of our clients come from Iraq and choosing to settle in the United States. So we've been dealing with a wave of refugees from the 90s, but we still work with a lot of other asylum seekers coming from African countries, a lot of Middle Africa, Cameroonian, mm-hmm. Congolese. Those specialize in asylum. They come here and they're seeking protection in the United States from the government of the United States by applying for asylum. And that's where we get a lot of our clients too from. So we come across a lot of diverse population, but the majority, like I say, are Iraqis.
And give us, if you can, some of the backstories of the refugees you work with to give us an understanding. Why were they forced to flee? What was happening that made them have to leave their homes and come to America?
The main reason behind all of refugee and asylum seekers is they're seeking safety. This is the main reason. They want to be in a safer place where they could be surviving and they're raising their family in a safer place. So seeking safety, this is the main reason for all refugee and asylum seekers. Let's say, for example, let's take the Iraqis, for example. I mean, the war during Saddam Hussein time, it was a lot of trauma. They experienced a lot of traumatic events, wars. That war with Iran lasted for about 10 years. It has a lot of impact on all Iraqis, and I'm talking about everybody. One of the statistics I read recently that widowed women in Iraq is 4 to 1. So we're talking about a large majority of women who've been widowed because of their husband serving in the Iraq-Iran war. Living in these countries took them a long while before they get recognized by United Nations as refugees. And then after that, they get the choice to where they want to settle. And a lot of those, been choosing to settle in the United States because of some of them have family members back here.
It's the beginning of a toehold.
It's the beginning, yeah.
Yes.
But the main reason I come across doing my work for the past 13 years with this population, mm-hmm. everybody is seeking safety. That's what they want to be in a safer place. They want to be protected.
And when the doors to this country are opened and these people are allowed to stay, it's for very good reason. What are some of the experiences?
They coming with something we call it a cumulative trauma. Many layers of a trauma because mm-hmm. of many reasons. Because I look at them in three stages. Experiences, traumatic events, whatever they witness before they flee their country. Mm-hmm. For example, Iraqis. Like I told you, during Saddam Hussein and then the war after that occupation. And then the most significant problem Iraq had, the sectarian violence that lasted for many years, even until now. It still exists in Iraq, forced these people to flee this country. But now this is the first stage I look at. Mm-hmm. Many, many experiences. They experienced war zones. They witnessed the killing, bodies in the streets. A lot of people experienced many, many traumatic events. I have many clients who tell me stories for they were targeted because just ethnic group, religious group, who they are, and believe it or not, even what they, you know, what they have, who they are. If you remember, the doctors were targeted
big time.
Professionals were targeted. I have a client, a young man, who came a few years back, and he the reason behind him torture. He was kidnapped, and they asked him for ransom for about 3 weeks. And during that 3 weeks, he was kidnapped. The main reason. They kidnapped him from the street because he was washing his car wearing a shirt. That's the only reason. And this kind of chaos, that's what they live on. So everybody, before they flee their country, we're talking about one stage of experience. Mm-hmm. Then you go to the next stage. During the flee from the country or where they settle, where they stay in. A lot of these refugees, example, Iraqis, they went to Jordan, Syria.
And they're in camps.
Camps.
Yeah.
They live in, but they have no access to any services, no health, no mental health, none of these things they have access to. It. And it took a while before United Nations recognized them mm-hmm. as refugees. So they live in a very, very bad circumstances. And then United States government assist this individual mm-hmm. with only 8 months of worth of assistance. Only 8 months. After 8 months, all your benefits are cut off. So for sure, they do have psychological problem. Mm-hmm. For sure, mm-hmm. they have mental health problem. And this is where I always been advocating on their behalf. For the past 13 years, I've been always advocating they need psychological assistance. They need psychological help.
I'm speaking today with Hussam Abdulkhalik, who is the program supervisor at the Access Psychosocial Rehabilitation Center, based in Dearborn, the largest Arab American human services nonprofit in the nation. And how are you able to help? Because we know money for mental health services is such a longstanding problem in Michigan. You've seen millions of dollars in mental health funding's been cut. Michigan closed more than 26 mental health institutions since 1981. So you've got the money obstacle. Are there other obstacles as well? Is there a stigma that keeps people from wanting to seek help?
Absolutely. We deal with all of these issues, especially the stigma, you know, mm-hmm. Especially for the Arabic cultures or all of these, we call them, I call them, it's conservative cultures where they came from. Mm-hmm. They deal with a lot of their psychological problem internally and within, inside their families and all that stuff. But when they have that many issues and they have many obstacles, and especially with the language, that's another thing. And then the funding, very, very, very minimum funding for all of these people. When we're talking about refugees, yeah. Iraqis came to the United States, we're talking about since 2007 until March 2013, 83,341 Iraqi refugees came. And many studies has indicated a large number, a larger percentage of this population have psychological problem. I'm going to point to you two studies.
Yes.
The most recent study done in Utah by one of the victim of torture centers like ours, they have a center there. They did the study on 500-something individuals on a survey to find out if they have psychological problem. They find out that 67% complain and suffer from psychological problem. Another study United Nations have done back in 2009-10, they interviewed about 2,000 individuals who entered from Iraq to Syria and Jordan. They interviewed them and asked them about psychological problems. They find out that 30 to 35% at least exhibit psychological, PTSD symptoms. So mm-hmm. we're talking about these at least two studies have been done indicating that they suffer from psychological problem.
As they're trying to set up a new life in this brand new world, and they're suffering from this, and they're not being treated, what is life like for these people?
It's going to continue to be traumatic on them. Mm. I mean, you're adding more layers of a trauma. And I've been seeing a lot of people who the minute, the first month they arrived in the United States, I saw them and I treated them as a clinician in my office. And then I saw individuals who went through all of this process. And I went after their benefits being cut off and all that stuff. All of this add to their trauma. I know. I seen it every day. I seen it with all of these anxiety symptoms increased, a lot of symptoms of PTSD, increase. They need a lot of help. They need a lot of psychological help. Now, this is how I see it. We bring these refugees to the United States. We bring them to be productive. But when they do have a psychological problem that is not treated, you're not creating a productive citizen. We're not.
And are you worried that you're going to have, with what's going on in Syria, do you see an influx of even more people?
Absolutely. We know that Syrians, refugees in Iraq and in Jordan and in neighboring countries like Turkey, Jordan and Lebanon, they're waiting for United Nations to recognize mm-hmm. them as refugees. And I know this is going to take an effect any time, because exactly that's what happens with the Iraqis. When that take effect, then they will be flooded everywhere. We're talking about close to 3 million, too, of Syrians now in the neighboring countries of refugees. That's a large, large number. And they've been through a lot of traumatic events, too, and they have a lot of problems. Those is going to be, I don't know exactly where they're going to be settled. I don't know. So far, we received a few refers, mm-hmm. but they did not enter the country as refugees. They enter country in different visas, but they have psychological problem. We've been helping them. But we're talking about individuals, not that massive numbers they will be coming. But I know that's coming.
And I guess I don't hear any solutions into this. I hear that you're in there working day after day after day. And it probably feels like you're trying to scale a mountain, but am I not hearing any kind of solution or any kind of summit where you could say we're in a better place for these people?
These individuals and these people comes with a holistic problems, mm-hmm. medical, psychological, basic needs, all of these things. It's a whole package. And when we're talking about individuals, we're talking about families too, their children and their wives and their husbands and all of that stuff. So imagine you dealing with this kind of population, with this kind of individual and family. They come with that much of a holistic needs.
And knowing that our state is cash strapped and social services have been cut, are you hoping for community support and volunteers, churches, physicians? What is it you hope that you will get from the community at large in Michigan?
I hope the community will contribute to their welfare. And I know the community being a very, very supportive to a lot of those individuals. One of the main reasons a lot of those individuals, mainly Iraqis, come to Michigan because they have family members mm-hmm. here. They seek that support. They want that support because they cannot depend on the other support coming from the state. We facing a major, major problem because it's a large number of refugees. And if we're not equipped as a state, as a country, as a government, as a community to work and to help to assist all of this large influx of refugee and population asylum seekers, it's always going to be a problem. It's always going to be a problem. Our program will only be able to serve about an average 300 clients per year. We're not equipped in a staff or services mm-hmm. to serve that much large population. And go back to the sticks I shared with you.
Yes.
If we're saying at least 50-60% of those have psychological problem, so when you treat not even 1%, you're leaving that other 49% and 50% untreated with that many problem. So it's a major issue and it has to be looked differently. They have to pay attention to the mental health component. By doing right screening from the beginning, by funding programs like ours and others in a state to provide services. And I know people who get the right help, they will be much, much more productive at the end.
And it all starts with awareness.
And we'll add to our country as, we want a productive citizen. And this is what we want at the end. This is the goal for everybody.
Hussan Abdulkhalik is the program supervisor. He works with refugees and asylum seekers at the Access Psychosocial Rehabilitation Center in Dearborn. And awareness is where it all begins, so you've certainly helped with that. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
12 years ago, St. Vincent's Catholic Charities in Lansing started a job training program for women refugees. But organizers soon realized these women needed something other than job training.
A lot of them, if you don't speak English, if you don't have a destination to go to, you can end up being incredibly isolated.
That's Jillian Olson. She shows up once a week to help lead a sewing circle teaching refugee women how to sew.
We just put this here for next week.
Sewing is important for a couple of reasons. It's a skill the women learn as part of their job training program, but it's also a way for the women to socialize and to share common experiences. At St. Vincent's Community Center, the women turn colorful rolls of fabric into shirts, pants, or blankets. Sharon Cambin-Timms has been a volunteer with the project since it launched 12 years ago.
As they talk, they identify common denominators. So for sure, they've all experienced trauma of some sort. They've all experienced loss. So they have those bonds that they share.
Organizers originally noticed the women struggling as they began to adjust to American work and life. To address those issues, they added a group therapy session to the sewing circle. During therapy, the women have tea, they have bagels, and a certified counselor leads the group. They talk about anything from a funny story to serious concerns. Volunteer Cambin-Timms says a common theme is the hope the women have for their families, especially their children.
Many of them, if not almost all of them, have children. And so one of the bonds that they share is an incredible desire for the lives of their children to be better, to come to a place that's safe, to come to a place where their children can have an education, to know, to really, really know that their strength and their ability to make a life here will set the course for their children.
And she's inspired by the strength and resilience of the women she meets.
They reinforce the reality that no matter what you have passed through, that you have to keep going. You have to keep going, and you have to make sense of it somehow and put it someplace and start over.
Organizers say this model of women sitting and talking happens all over the world. By taking this tradition and combining it with a modern touch of therapy, they found a creative way to help women make huge transitions in their lives. The program meets once a week on Fridays at the St. Vincent's Catholic Charities Community Center in Lansing. For more information about this women's sewing circle, just visit their website, stvcc.org. Former Michigan Supreme Court Justice Diane Hathaway was sentenced for fraud in federal court today in Ann Arbor. Hathaway was forced to resign in January, halfway through her 8-year term on the state Supreme Court. She resigned before she pled guilty to a scheme to cheat a bank by hiding assets, including a vacation home in Florida. That helped her qualify as a distressed homeowner so she could then sell a lakefront home in Grosse Pointe Park as a short sale. Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network, has been following this story for us. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Cindy.
So fill us in. What was the former justice's sentence?
Well, apparently the judge in the case gave more weight to what the prosecutors asked for than what Justice Hathaway's attorney asked for, and gave her a year and a day, 12 months and 1 day in prison, which was at the bottom end of what the prosecution was seeking in this case. And so that suggests that, well, the judge said that he put the bank's losses at closer to $90,000, which is what the prosecutor claimed it was in this case, as opposed to $40,000, which is what the defense said in this case. And because these things are scored, there's actually sort of there's math to it, that that would have brought down her sentence even more. Mm-hmm. She had wanted to serve probation in Florida out of the vacation home that actually almost got seized by the federal government, but she was able to keep as part of her plea deal.
And her defense attorneys had some hopes of keeping her right out of prison, didn't they?
Yes, they did. They argued for probation. They said that no purpose would be served by sending the justice to prison, that she'd already suffered humiliation here in Michigan. She lost her law license, her real estate license, and in fact, she is now basically living in Florida to hide from the shame of what she's experienced here in Michigan. And they said that this would be a chance for her to give something back in causes that she's already served. In some respects, she cares a lot about cancer, having lost her mother and her sister to that. And there's also a homeless shelter nearby her home in Florida that they would have liked to have her do her community service in.
But she has got the 12 months and a day. Would she be serving that in Michigan, Rick?
We don't know yet. That in things like this, you go in and you get processed and you get assessed based on things like what kind of an escape risk you are, how troublesome you might be. My guess would be that she would be sent to a minimum security facility, much like the one that we saw former Detroit City Councilwoman Monica Conyers sent to. But we don't know yet because she's got to go through the assessment. And we should also point out that she owes $90,000 in restitution, that amount that we mentioned before,
mm-hmm.
and her attorney says she will pay it right away.
Now, how surprised should we all be by this sentence?
Well, this type of bank fraud, it's unusual for it to be prosecuted in this fashion, so we don't really have anything to compare it to on that front. But the fact that she was a public official and a high-profile public official means that it's really not a surprise that she got some prison, plus an additional 2 years of probation. The last time we saw something like this on the state Supreme Court was in the middle 1970s when Justice John Swainson, who was also a former governor, he was charged with bribery and perjury. And he was acquitted on the bribery charge, but he was convicted of lying about it, which was also considered kind of unique. And he also had to leave the court under the cloud of a felony. So when public officials get charged like this, that you know, you can expect that a judge is going to lean away from leniency for leniency's sake.
And briefly, what kind of impact do you think this would have on the state's highest court?
Well, it's obviously not going away, but any institution that really survives and thrives on public trust doesn't like to something like this happened, and the court, as much as possible, has really been trying to just keep its distance from this, and to the degree that it involves at all, it's just that early on the Chief Justice said that Diane Hathaway should explain herself, and then they just kind of went silent and let the system play out, and hopefully people will just think that this is a rogue judge, a rogue attorney, and not someone who's reflective on the judicial system.
Rick Pluta is the Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. And Rick, we should note, we'll be talking with you and our executive producer, Zoe Clark, on tomorrow's show, because both of you, along with Michigan Radio's political analyst Jack Lesenberry, will be covering the annual Detroit Regional Chamber Policy Conference on Mackinac Island. So we look forward to speaking with you then as you pack your suitcase. We'll get all the details on the annual meeting of Michigan's lawmakers and business community and policymakers. So
a lot of politics to talk about. Looking forward to it.
Absolutely. We'll talk with you from Mackinac. One of the leading topics of statewide conversation is how to keep young professionals and college grads in Michigan, not heading out of state. Lately on Stateside, we've heard talk of placemaking, ways to make our cities more attractive to young people. It's one of many ideas being tossed around in the quest to prevent what's called brain drain. Joining me now is writer Natalie Berg. Her recent guest column in Bridge Magazine caught our eye because Natalie is 31, and she writes from the perspective of those young people that we're trying to keep in Michigan, and she thinks some of these strategies just aren't going to do the trick. Natalie joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, Cynthia.
So what were you saying in your column to Bridge, and who were you saying it to?
First and foremost, I'd like to clarify that I do think the placemaking efforts are wonderful.
But
I think they're amazing. I think they are an excellent first step.
Yeah, you say that's only half of the equation.
Right, right. And to the credit of all of the people involved in placemaking, whether it is the state agencies, the local governments, the nonprofits, and the actual businesses who are now funding some of these, this is the most they can do. Mm-hmm. And they're doing everything they can. They can't necessarily change the policies that mm-hmm. Also tend to deter millennials and younger professionals from making a home here.
So that's kind of what you're saying. Placemaking's great. Yay, placemaking. But
placemaking is about more than physical things. It's about what kind of place are we making here in Michigan? Are we making a place where people feel that they can have equal access to affordable health care, whether they are male or female? Do we feel like this is a place where people of all sexual orientations can have equal protections under the law? These are real life things that people I know are considering when they're deciding where to settle down. And unfortunately, certain things about Michigan law does not encourage that.
Or certain conversations held by people who are prominent in Michigan. I
yes.
will throw out the name of Dave Ajima, the mm-hmm. Republican National Committeeman, with those postings on Facebook and comments about gays. How did that set with your with millennials?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, in some ways, you're just like, come on, guys. Uh-huh. Everyone can hear you. And what was really off-putting to me, as someone who I dedicate my career to writing about Michigan and development and moving things forward. So I am more or less a professional cheerleader for Michigan. And when something like that happens, I feel like it not only does that make the state sound bad, but I feel personally like, come on, you're making my life harder here. I can't win this argument about how great of a place Michigan is to live when that is something that people from across the country hear. They can hear you out there, and it's kind of embarrassing.
And I know, I mean, we had Republican activist Dennis Lennox on, who he and many other young Republicans basically had the very same reaction you did. So what I think the larger issue is that you have a lot of 50 and 60-somethings who are policymakers, who are political leaders, who are urban planners, who are running companies and deciding benefits. And so they're thinking from that being 58 years old perspective.
Right. The beginning of my column has a little illustration, which got a little more attention than it intended to. But it was showing when I first got a real person job mm-hmm. after getting my master's degree. And I was very proud of myself for having a real salary. And I thought I'd gotten this great employment package from it was a city in Michigan. And a coworker pulled me aside and was just so apologize for how I had just gotten hoodwinked by our HR department because they had not offered pensions, offered me a pension. Well, I mean, those don't exist anymore, for one thing. But it had not even crossed my mind that, A, I should be asking for a pension, or B, that I was interviewing for a job where I was about to spend the next 30 years. Because that's just not how my generation works. And that's not a personal opinion. That's just the facts.
So your generation is not going to say, okay, I'm in my job and I'm going to stay here till it's time to get my watch and retire.
Right, right. We're a generation that are focused on a career path rather than a job. And this has been, it's been headed in this direction for a while. The generation in front of us, Generation X, started verging in that direction as well.
So to someone who has the perspective of being 58 or 59 and realizes, guess what, kids? If you don't have that pension plan or you're not saving for retirement, it comes roaring up on you faster than you figure. Can you get that?
I absolutely do. And I heard that a lot this week. And I thought, well, I could put you in touch with my financial planner because I have one. Mm-hmm. And I am saving for retirement. Thank you very much. And I mean, let's be honest. If someone wanted to hand me a salary when I turn 65, I would be happy to take that. But pensions are crippling budgets right now, whether it's school systems or cities or the state. And for that reason, they're not being offered. And it's, you know, for better or for worse, it's a good thing for the economy. We can't handle those anymore.
I'm talking with writer Natalie Berg, who had a recent guest column in Bridge Magazine that is entitled Michigan's Detours into Social Issues Won't Help Attract Young Talent. And truly that sense of the brain drain is something that consumes a lot of leaders in Michigan, from Governor Snyder, who has talked about what do we need to keep these graduates here in our state, not having them head to Chicago or New York or wherever they're going, Atlanta. So from your point of view, what solid things can be done to keep millennials in Michigan and calling Michigan home?
We are hearing more and more that people are deciding where to live mm-hmm. and then going to find a job there.
I heard that. We had the big placemaking segment a couple of weeks ago, and I did not know that from my perspective because my baby boomer generation, we found the job and we packed up and moved.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So that is a fact. So it is true that these actual physical placemaking things are important, but it's also important when people weigh out where they're going to choose to live, mm-hmm. they are weighing the social issues. When the Supreme Court was listening to the arguments for marriage equality, I, with great interest, took this calculator thing on CNN that showed where your state ranked in order of your personal LGBT priorities. And if you plug in basically for each answer that you have, it's a high priority for you to have equal rights for LGBT citizens. Mm-hmm. Michigan was way down on the list. And that is a calculator that was on CNN that is easy for anybody to use. And I know if I didn't live in Michigan and I was thinking about living in Michigan, mm-hmm. that would be a factor for me.
Hmm. That's something that, as you say, millennials in general are sensitive to that.
Sure.
It's not something necessarily that we see. Now, we talked about Dave Ajima's comments. That's one example, and there were many abashed Republicans in Michigan after that happened.
Sure.
What other kinds of things have happened, things have been said, or issues that strike a wrong chord with millennials?
It's been a wild year for that.
No problem finding things, huh?
particularly, December itself was a stunning month.
With lame duck.
Yes. Setting aside the right to work things, which I don't think that necessarily appeals more or less to one generation or another, mm-hmm. with all of that to do covering that, there were bills that further restricted women's health care access, slipped right in there. Some of the same bills that got a lot of attention over the summer, if you'll recall, when Representative Lisa Brown was reprimanded for using...
saying vagina on the floor
yeah.
of the state legislature. Yeah.
And then, thousands of us converged on the Capitol and held a vagina monologues viewing there, which was an amazing event. And even with all of that outpouring and all of that that vocalizing from the citizenry that you won't do this to us, they did. And they did it kind of quietly, actually.
Is that a challenge to other millennials to run for office and take the place of some of these older folks that aren't striking the right chord?
It is. It is. And I think that far be it for me to sit here and say that we are the generation, the blessed generation that come to serve us. We do need to be more active. We need to get out from behind our online petitions and our, boldly stated things on Facebook that only our friends hear. And we need to say something out loud. We do need to run for office. We do need to be more public, because I think between how easy it is to express your opinion in a comfortable, safe way for our generation.
Sitting at your laptop.
Right, sitting at your laptop.
Or your iPad or whatever.
Yes, under in any disguised username you want.
Uh-huh.
It's easy to do that. And then many of us also have parents that are in a generation that may disagree with our opinion. So we tend to just kind of be quiet about it.
And by the way, we parents went through that with our parents.
It's
because
true,
you think about it,
true.
The baby boomers went through that with the greatest generation parents. So, that line from the Who, meet the old boss, same as the, meet the new
right,
boss, same as the old
right,
boss.
Right,
rings
it's,
true.
It rings true. It rings true. And it's not necessarily true. It's not all of everyone in the baby boomer generation does not disagree
right.
with our political opinions.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think you've given us a lot to think about. And I want to end by asking you, You stated right at the beginning of our interview that you are a cheerleader for Michigan. So tell us what it is about Michigan that makes you feel so passionate about this state.
Oh, my goodness. The end of the interview. We might need to do a whole nother one. I love Michigan. I have an emotional attachment to Michigan. My family's here. I grew up here. I come from a GM family two generations back. So it's very much a place that I love personally and emotionally, but it's also it's a beautiful state. It's a diverse state. I think people who live here underestimate both our physical size and our incredible diversity and the spirit of people who live here. And one of my favorite things about Michigan right now, and I know people love to talk about what's wrong with Michigan right now, mm-hmm. but my favorite thing about the state right now is that everybody who felt lukewarm about Michigan gone. They left, they went for better jobs, wherever. And it just feels like a state that is full of people who love being here and want to make it better. And I think that that energy is something that we can harness to work on issues just like we were talking about today, as well as is already being harnessed to bolster our economy and rebuild Detroit and all sorts of great things that are happening.
So to the politicians in Lansing, the local politicians, urban planners, leaders of the state Democratic and state Republican parties, you say?
I say it's my political opinions aside, the facts are the facts. And if we're already investing in getting millennials here, we have to make that investment worth it by completing making Michigan a place that's truly going to attract them.
Natalie Berg, her recent guest column in Bridge Magazine was titled "Michigan's Detours into Social Issues Won't Help Attract Young Talent." Thanks for talking with us on the program today.
Thank you, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
And that's Stateside for today. Thanks for listening. We talk tomorrow at 3:00.